Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is Lucky, episode 13, where we will be talking with Caroline Toy about Harry Potter fan pilgrimages. Thanks for joining us for Reading, Writing, Rolling. Today's topic is coming to us right in the thick of travel season. So maybe some of you summer travelers have Harry Potter destinations, and I hope that you'll find this topic to be really relevant to your summer. I am your host, Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. Our resident expert is John Granger, the Dean of Harry Potter Scholars and author of numerous books about the Harry Potter series, including the Deathly Hallows Lectures. How are you doing today, John?
We're sweating it out here in Oklahoma City, Katie.
Oh, yeah. Summertime in Oklahoma. Oh, my gosh.
Woohoo!
So I know, John, that you are particularly excited about the next Cormoran Strike book that we just got a blurb about, Letha White, and we have a release date. What are you excited about there?
Well, the fact that we have a release date is a matter for backflips and pom-poms. the story blurb that she gave us, we don't know if it's about a man saying that he saw a murder up by the horse. And we don't know if it's actually a horse because Letha White is an equine disease, or whether it's a local dialect for house. But it's an exciting thing, and we're looking forward to hearing about. We're probably going to get a few more clues, maybe a first chapter in the run-up to September's release.
Awesome. Very good. Well, today we are joined by a friend of the show, Dr. Beatrice Groves, who is a research fellow at Oxford University and the author of Literary Illusion in Harry Potter. Really wonderful book there. Welcome back to the show, Bea.
Hi, Katie. Thanks for inviting me back. Lovely to be here.
And, John and Bea, I'm so excited for our topic today because tourism and travel literature are kind of, tourism is something newer that I'm getting into, but travel literature, I did my dissertation on history of travel literature, and I just published an edited volume that is sort of stretching the boundaries of what we consider tourism and pilgrimage. So today's topic is just, right in my wheelhouse. The book is Virtual Dark Tourism, Ghost Roads by Paul Grave. And you may not know what virtual dark tourism is, but everybody's been a dark tourist. It's going to sites of calamity, death, disaster. We seem to feel compelled to do that. But my book is really about how people can do this even without going anywhere by reading a book about a journey to, a disastrous location. Film and television, the internet, even video games can, I think, take you places. So I'm really interested to bring the world of Harry Potter fandom into my thinking about, travel and tourism. And, of course, the topic of pilgrimage today. So without further ado, our special guest today is Caroline Toy, a PhD candidate in the Department of Comparative Studies at The Ohio State University. She has a Master of Arts degree from Ohio State, as well as a Master's in Education from Georgia College and State University, and her bachelor's degree is from Williams College. Caroline's areas of expertise include religion and popular culture, folklore, pilgrimages and tourism, and fan studies. And her current project is on Harry Potter, Doctor Who, and Sherlock film location pilgrimages. Welcome to the show, Caroline.
Hi, Katie. Thanks for having me.
So this spring, I heard Caroline present on Harry Potter fan pilgrimages at the National Popular Cultural Association Conference. And it was so thought-provoking that I just knew I wanted to talk about what she's working on, talk about her research. So, Caroline, let's just get right into this. We normally ask our guests about when they first turned an academic eye to the Harry Potter books, but let me ask you more specifically to our topic today, when did you first consider analyzing your Harry Potter fan experiences from an academic perspective?
You know, that's a really interesting question. If you had asked me when I first turned an academic eye to the Harry Potter books, it might actually have been easier. I was working in an adventure education program and had gotten involved in a number of fandoms in my free time because I had more free time than you do as a graduate student, and started to think about turning an academic eye toward fandom. Mm-hmm. And then thinking academically about Harry Potter fandom for me came later. I kind of came into it through thinking academically about Doctor Who fandom. So it was kind of an organic development as I was turning into going back to academia in general.
Mm-hmm. So you were you had already read the Harry Potter books, but you were not first going into Harry Potter fandom. You were more in the Doctor Who fandom.
Right. I read the Harry Potter books when they were originally released in the United States in the late 90s and early to mid 2000s. And I saw the movies when they came out and definitely considered myself a Harry Potter fan. But the things that I was most invested in as a fan when I started thinking academically about fandom just didn't happen to be Harry Potter. And then as this project developed, thinking about fan pilgrimage, it became really clear really quickly that Harry Potter was really productive. And I loved it so much. You know, I had been to the studio tour in London. I'd been to a couple places in Edinburgh. And it just seemed like a really great fit and something I was excited to think more about.
That's great. Now, so let's talk a little bit about some of the Harry Potter fan activity. You were talking about how Harry Potter fandom is productive. And of course, as you say, one of the things that it's producing a lot of are these tours. But you call Potter fans who visit sites like the Warner Brothers Studio Tour and Platform 9 and 3 Quarters pilgrims. Now, why would you use that word in particular instead of calling them tourists or something else?
The reason that I use it is because I want to turn my attention and turn the attention of people that I'm talking with to specific characteristics of fan pilgrimages in general and what Harry Potter fans are doing. So I'm thinking about ritual. I'm thinking about how sacred space is created, how people use traveling as a way of making meaning, and how spaces and texts are related in the minds of fans to kind of generate this sense of fanish identity and belonging. So that's why I tend to use the word pilgrimage instead of tourism in my own work. And I do that saying that pilgrims are still tourists. Like, we're still also talking about tourism. And a lot of people who go to the studio tour or the Elephant House or any of these sites would say, yes, I'm a tourist. I'm not a pilgrim. So I want to leave space for that as well in this discussion.
So do you think there are some people who are approaching it more like a pilgrim and some people who are more being a tourist? Or is there, I mean, does it require consciousness on the part of the person who's traveling?
I think it's very subtle, and I think people can actually, you know, kind of slide from being more of a tourist to being more of a pilgrim, sort of depending on the type of experience that they're having. They might go to a place expecting to have like a really intense emotional experience. I've been in situations like this where I went somewhere I expected to like connect immediately to this place that I had seen on screen and the, you know, emotions of the scene that was filmed there and stuff, and just didn't have that experience. And then there might be people who go saying, yeah, we'll go to the Warner Brothers studio tour, it'll be fun, it's a, you know, famous attraction, and then they end up having a really intense emotional experience that makes them really think about their relationship to Harry Potter that they weren't expecting. So I don't think that people have to make this conscious distinction. I think some people do, and that's really interesting, but that the categories are really porous.
When I was doing some dark tourism research, they talk about how people can kind of accidentally become dark tourists. And it sounds like you can maybe, I don't know, can you accidentally fall into a pilgrimage experience where you've done this travel and that it has called forth a sort of intense emotional reaction that you maybe didn't intend to have, you didn't expect you were going to have it.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think it could be an emotional reaction. It could be that the experience influences you in ways that you weren't expecting. And that happens on pilgrimages that we would think of as traditionally religious as well. You know, there are people who walk to Santiago not expecting to find a lot of meaning in going to the church service at the cathedral at the end, and then they do have really emotional experiences, or people who go and end up questioning their faith.
I'm really interested by that, Caroline, and I've written an article on 16th, 17th century English Protestant travelers to Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. When they published their accounts of the journey, they would say, this is not a pilgrimage account, you know, that I am just a traveler, and I wanted to see Jerusalem. But then when they get there, they go to all the same places that pilgrims went. They kneel and say psalms the first time they see the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, for example. They go into the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and lock themselves in for the whole Triduum, Maundy Thursday to Easter Day. And you say, you know, so my article was just about how can these people possibly not be pilgrims? And so I totally agree with you that I think the interaction between sort of traveling somewhere and traveling somewhere in a pilgrim capacity is a really interesting one. I probably have more of a sort of slight issue about the idea, though, that it's the same thing as a normal pilgrimage if there's no God. So I do think those Protestants, they still believed in God, so they didn't think of themselves as having a place-centered view of holiness, and I think they did, even though they didn't think they did. But they did still believe in God. So when they went to Jerusalem, they couldn't help feeling Jesus walked on these stones. And while I shouldn't therefore feel that these stones are more holy than any other stones, I do. but that's quite a different thing, it seems to me. This place is connected to Harry Potter. And so I have... So I'd just like to talk more about what that might mean. So you've been talking so far about emotion, so people having a strong emotional response to their travel. And I completely agree with that. But I suppose the issue would just be whether it's in any way sacred. Is it in any way set apart from normal life in any religious sense? Or is it just linking to the same habits of mind in us that we, you know, we can't help feel called to particular places and to feel those places resonate with us?
I think it's some of both. I think the example that you raise there is really interesting when you say the Protestants are saying, no, we're good Protestants. Like, there's nothing more sacred about these stones. And yet, you know, Jesus walked here. And in some ways, to me, that sounds like a narratively motivated pilgrimage rather than people going somewhere and saying, well, this physical space is obviously more sacred than, you know, the physical space that I'm from. And one of the sort of arguments that I would make that some people have made about secular pilgrimages is that narrative motivation is a really important part of those as well.
Could you just take us through a bit more what narratively motivated pilgrimage means?
Yeah, so the desire to essentially, in some cases, reenact a narrative or be in mm-hmm. the place where a narrative happens. So in some ways to participate, you know, by proxy. So folks who go to Jerusalem even today and, you know, walk the places that Jesus is said to have walked on the last day of his life, for example, that would be a narratively motivated pilgrimage because they're basing what they're doing, you know, ritually and spiritually on a narrative that they've received, you know, in a religious context.
Do you know Egeria? I think that's how you pronounce her name, the first pilgrim who we have any account. She went to Jerusalem in the sort of 4th century. And she, that's exactly what she does. She goes to the places she knows from the Bible and she reads out the passage of the Bible that happens in that place.
Wow,
in the place. And that's the first account we have of a Christian pilgrim to Jerusalem. And I think it's really fascinating, and I don't know what evidence there might be, but it seems to me that the whole liturgical year might come out of that kind of pilgrimage, that kind of idea that you have a sort of, basically that what becomes in pilgrim sense a place where you read that narrative becomes in a liturgical sense the time when mm-hmm. you read that narrative, because that's available to everyone throughout the world.
Yeah, and of course we don't have that type of you know, liturgy and time when we have these fan pilgrimages. But I think that there's something structurally similar in terms of how narrative is brought to life in space, and how people either literally or figuratively do the equivalent of reading a particular Bible passage in a particular place. And that might just mean, like, in a place like the Warner Brothers studio tour or the Doctor Who experience, like, sometimes there's videos playing, or sometimes there's, you know, sets that have been reconstructed for a particular scene to evoke these moments in the narrative, even if it's not quite as linear.
I think you feel the same way as about this, but one of the things this idea of a narratively motivated pilgrimage seems to me to get to the heart of it is the difference between the films and the books and how we feel about that. And so to me, the Warner Brothers studio, it's only, as it were, fakely related to the narrative, that it's been built around the narrative. It didn't pre-exist the narrative. Whereas places that Rowling might have seen and been inspired by before she wrote have quite a different power in their relation to the narrative, just like Jerusalem does to the Bible. You know, the Bible's written after Jesus was in Jerusalem, those parts of the Bible. That seems to me to be much more a fruitful engagement of place and narrative. So The film is after the fact. You know, the book has been created and the film looks for locations that might match and then creates them.
But if you're going to the coffee shop where J.K. Rowling was writing, it's a bit different.
That's right. You look out the window and you see this riddle tomb that you might have seen that might have given her the idea, and that seems much more sort of exciting and emotionally exciting than going to a fake version of the riddle tomb in the Warner Brothers studio. To me, I don't know what Caroline thinks about that.
So you're suggesting, Bea, that a trip to Orlando or LA or any of the places where they have these movie exhibits that recreate a Hogsmeade, say, is because it doesn't pre-exist the story, is not as engaging or meaningful. I struggle with that, but as maybe a trip to Exeter and the places that resemble streets, or the streets in Edinburgh that look like Diagon Alley,
Yes, I definitely think that. So in terms of the narrative related, so you know, places where, so you know, for example, of things that in other types of narrative, you go to Coleridge's cottage in Nether Stowey and you see the room in which he wrote Frost on Midnight, and you see the place he was sitting there, and that feels quite different to me than going to a mock-up of that room somewhere else.
Right. Like, if you go to Oxford, you're in Oxford, correct?
Yeah, yes.
If you're a tourist in Oxford and you go to the Eagle and Childs, you know, because of C.S. Lewis or J.R.R. Tolkien, that's doing something very different from going to the Warner Brothers studio tour for Harry Potter. But I think it also has to do with what motivates people and what their relationships are to, you know, the movies versus the books. And some people, I think, are more invested in the movies than in the books, and are not necessarily all that interested in what I would call the backstory of the narrative. So, you know, the Riddle Grave or the Elephant House, places that are really important to how Rowling kind of invented the books, but don't necessarily have that connection to what happens in them.
I want to jump in here because you cite, in your bibliography at least, you have Iliade's Sacred and the Profane. And, you know, what's known in Harry Potter fandom as the Iliade thesis is that it explains the popularity of the books is that what Iliade says about narrative experience or story in a secular culture is that it supplies a mythic or religious experience to people who don't believe in transcendent reality. And so that, back to Bea's point about, it's not a pilgrimage if there's no transcendent reality or God involved. How can this be sacred or meaningful if there isn't a there, if there isn't some means to grace to some external reality. This, I mean, Harry Potter has a may serve a mythical religious function because it's in a secular culture, but as there is no Harry Potter God and there are no graces consequent to that, how can a pilgrimage site either to where Rowling wrote the books or to a film which is entirely about where the capitalist function precedes any kind of mythic experience? How can that be seen as sacred? I mean, there's another podcast called Harry Potter is Sacred Text that makes this fundamental error that Harry Potter is a sacred text because people think it is. It may serve a mythic or religious function, but it doesn't have a means of grace to it.
Well, I mean, I think I would push back on the idea that all pilgrimages have to be religious in a way that talks about God, because I think when you look at a lot of studies of pilgrimage in the postmodern era, if you're looking at Santiago, you could be looking at Jerusalem, you could be looking at any number of places that are sort of labeled as religious pilgrimage sites, or obviously have connotations of people, arguing about whose religion should be represented in a place like Glastonbury, which is a big attractant for both Christian pilgrims and neo-pagans. You're going to find people in any of those places who are not going there because they believe in God or because they're particularly devoted to the saint that's represented there or something like that. So I would say that I think we need to think about what pilgrimage is and what sacredness is in ways that don't rely on a divine person, right? That don't rely on sort of this Western Christian idea of religious redemption, because there are other types of narrative that people use to create myth. And myth like religion is one of those categories that's a little bit hard to define.
Caroline, one of the things that you talk about in terms of the pilgrimages is that there's a way in which people are within the ordinary are pulled out into something extraordinary. And I wonder if that's not a way to kind of conceive of the pilgrim experience being different from the tourist experience, that they have been pulled into something that does seem transcendent to them, that is pulling them into an extraordinary experience that is going to feel sacred or is going to have that kind of meaning for them.
Right. So sort of the way that I approach this when I think about the structure of fan pilgrimage places is, I like to think about what are the places that are there, right? There's like the literal place where you are, which to kind of turn to think about a different example, there's, as many listeners may be aware, there's a luggage trolley that's attached to the wall in King's Cross Station in London. That has been a destination for Harry Potter fans for quite some time. And Warner Brothers now runs a gift shop that's next to it. And there's a professional photographer who will take your picture, pushing this trolley into the wall. And it's become kind of a thing. But it is still in the middle of King's Cross Railway Station. And there are people in line with their luggage. And there are people buying their tickets, across the hall and stuff like that. So when we think about a place like that, for example, there's layers of spaces there, right? There's the ordinary space, which is the train station. There is the idea that some filming was conducted in the train station, although not right there. So there's this history of production. And then there's this moment where fans sort of imaginatively cross this threshold into the world of Harry Potter. So you can act as though you are about to cross onto platform 9 3/4, have one of Harry's earliest glimpses into the wizarding world, and go off to Hogwarts. Now, does anybody actually believe that that's going to happen? No, of course not. Fans have a very clear idea of what's part of fandom, what's part of a text, and then what's part of being in King's Cross Station. But when you're in a place like that, and you have this sense of multiple realities that really are intersecting, knowing that that's not true. And here I think is a difference between how we should conceive of fan pilgrimages and how we might conceive of religious faith. Fans know that this super normal thing that they're engaging with is not factually true. But the fact that they embrace this fiction and engage with it as if it were real, I think there's where we start to see something a little more similar to traditional religious engagement. And that comes through this overlap of essentially worlds in a specific space.
So Caroline, I will tell you that I did go to Platform 9 3/4 and I got a picture of myself. This is before they had the photographer there. They just had the half trolley there, long time ago now. But my sister-in-law just this past weekend had been to London, and she did the whole deal where there's a person who flings the scarf behind you so you look like you're flying into the wall. And she and my brother-in-law are showing me all of these pictures of them doing it. And I thought this is also a part of the narrative that you are able to tell when you're back from that experience. You know, you go and then you've got a story to tell. You've got a picture to show of you like headed off to Hogwarts, right? Engaging in that fiction fully. And there's something that is really, I think, that's joyful about that anyway. Go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
And this is my sort of cold water, is that to me, it matters that she wasn't thinking of King's Cross Station when she wrote that. She was thinking of Euston. She got them confused.
Right.
The things she describes doesn't look like King's Cross Station. And I'm bothered by that. I would much rather have something that looked like how it's described in the book. That's where I'd like to go. So I would find going to Euston and seeing the bit that looks like the way she describes more meaningful for me.
Yes,
that's
but you know, B, I mean, that was the speech that I gave to my husband when we were doing it. I was like, oh yeah, you know, this isn't really the da 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 da. So I had, you know, my critical joy in that as well. I don't
have more joy, not less. More joy, yeah.
And I don't mean to say that there's no critique in that joy, because when you're at Platform 9 3/4, particularly now that they've got the shop there and everything, and you know, fans have written about this, fan studies people have written about this, you are in the middle of a train station, and in many ways that's very distracting. You're standing in an organized line, and you know that act in and of itself, like, you might be really excited about being at Platform 9 3/4, but it really doesn't feel like you're on Platform 9 3/4 while you're waiting to have your picture. So there's always this tension, right? Just as there is in any kind of pilgrimage experience, I think, you know, where you are going to a place that for whatever reason you consider sacred and you treat ritually, but somebody's trying to sell you something along the way.
Right, and you talk about mediation and how these sites are often mediating the fan experience, and it sounds to me like, you know, the line queuing up and, you know, having a certain order to it is part of that mediation. What are some other kinds of mediation that fans are likely to encounter in their pilgrimages to Harry Potter sites?
So when I think of mediation, I think of basically anything that makes the site feel a little bit like a less direct experience of connecting with Harry Potter or with Rowling or with the, you know, history of production or whatever. So in the case of Platform 9 3/4, since we're there, my understanding, and I didn't see it at this point, but my understanding is the original luggage trolley was kind of there on the wall, and Katie, maybe you can correct me here, and you went and took your picture with it. And like,
yes.
There it was.
And there was no line, yeah. Also. So
right.
It was just
was
me
no
walking
line.
Up to it, my husband snapping the picture. It was my faculty right. photo for a while, I have to say.
I like that. And now you have the line, as you say, you have the gift shop and sort of the expectation that people are going to, if not buy anything, like go in there and look at the stuff. And kind of being in the site in a way that's filtered through merchandising creates a very different experience from probably the experience you had, and kind of produces a sense of Platform 9 3/4 that is more, I mean, it's already very film-based because of where it is filmed versus how it's described in the books, but it's very much filtered through Warner Brothers' idea of how people should, you know, encounter and consume and enjoy the Harry Potter films. And that's probably very different if you go at 6 o'clock in the morning when the shop's not open, or if you went, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. So there's those types of mediations, commercial mediations, mm-hmm. Which you would also see at the studio tour. And, you know, in a museum type space, there are all kinds of other mediations too. What type of information are you being given? Like, what do the captions on the display case say? What do the guides who show you the Dumbledore's office set say? Like, what behind the scenes information do they give you? What do they not give you? And then even really, you know, basic things like how are props displayed? How are set pieces displayed? Which side of them do you see? One really interesting thing that I found in the studio tour is that you often have recreations of a full set, sometimes including, you know, mannequins with the original costumes, that's clearly set up to say, hey, this is what the Gryffindor common room would look like if you were really there. And literally next to it, there'll be a set piece or a prop or something that was built to create an optical illusion or to work with digital art. So like next to the Gryffindor common room set at the studio tour, you have a section of the Hogwarts moving staircase, and they've turned it so that you can see the side that's bright green, the side that was created to work with the digital movement that they were going to add later. So you have these interesting combinations of realism and then like outright discussions of, you know, here's how we faked this. And that to me is really interesting because it's taking you into the production world, sort of giving you the sense that you're going behind the scenes into the history of the Harry Potter films. And then at the next turn saying, hey, look, this is what it's really like.
Here's the man behind the curtain.
Yeah. Here's the man behind the curtain, but also here's you like getting as close as you can to encountering this other world as if you were a Hogwarts student.
The thing you said about waiting in line and the way in which that sort of takes away from the experience, I had that same feeling queuing to get into the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in the Anastasis Rotunda, the actual place where the tomb is, because the rest of the church is nice and big, but there's, you know, there's an hour queue to get into that, into the sepulchre. And something I did feel about it, though, is obviously you do kind of feel waiting in the queue, this isn't, I'm not having any deep spiritual feelings here, but I quite like the way that it was connecting me to medieval pilgrims. I felt that over 1,000 years people have been queuing here, and it was the most, you know, the most literal experience of being a medieval pilgrim. This is what they were really, you know. So there was an old priest who, the moment you got in there, 3 people could fit in, and the moment you got in there, he would rush you out again. And I thought, someone has been doing that for 1,000 years, and that actually is my most medieval experience of this whole moment. So I quite liked it in a way.
Longest queue ever.
Right. Yeah. No, I have a very similar experience from Santiago. When you go to the cathedral at Santiago, behind the altar, there is this bejeweled statue of St. James. And you can get at it by climbing up some stairs into this area that, I mean, it literally is just above the altar. And if you're there during a church service, they let people continue to go up to the statue of St. James. And so there's this constant stream of people all the time when the church is open who are climbing up these stairs. They go up to the statue of the saint and they hug him and whisper a request, you know, or a prayer or something in the ear of the statue. And that's been happening, you know, for hundreds of years, probably not the 1,000-year length of the pilgrimage, but quite a long time. So yeah, in a sense, it is a really, really long line. And the anticipation of that, of saying, you know, well, what am I going to say? What am I going to do? You know, how much time am I going to have? I think that, you know, it takes you back into the history of places like Santiago or the Holy Sepulchre. But it can also give you a sense of being part of this large community that isn't all there, and maybe even doesn't really exist as a community as we would normally think of it, but you have this sense of belonging. And I think that that is common too. You know, at the studio tour, you wait in this long queue to be allowed into kind of the intro films area to go through the tour. And there's a little, you know, reconstruction of Harry's covered under the stairs, but really you're just waiting in line, and you're waiting in line with a lot of other people who are, you know, literally screaming with excitement. And so, you know, you don't have the sense of history that you do at, you know, Jerusalem or Santiago, but you do have this sense of, I am about to belong to something that is much bigger than I am, that I think is really important.
And I do agree with you that this sense of community is something that it both types of pilgrimage give, and that is obviously something that, you know, a traditional view of a religious experience is a one of the primary points of a pilgrim style is bringing your own individual experience into a community and into relationship with others, and that is what, you know, church, as it were, is all about. And I can see that that's something that remains powerful, whatever it is that is connecting you.
I love this idea that, you know, it's lines are very, very much a communal space. Sometimes I don't think about that because I'm trying not to pay attention to what's happening in the line, but I do revolutionary history, and like lines are a big deal. Like if people are lining up and they're unhappy, I always tell my students, like, you've been in the DMV when the line's not moving. You know, a line is a dangerous place to be potentially.
Yeah.
But this is a very positive experience of a line, in the sense of that the line is building anticipation, but you're also there with other people who are similarly anticipating. They are. And what I'm really interested in is you're part of a group already because you're in the line. You're part of that community. But the anticipation is that after you see the thing, you will be part of an even better or more exclusive community because you will have seen it. You will have been there.
Right. And you do, like, in a sense, it generates status for you as a fan or as a, you know, religious person, depending, or as a person who has a driver's license, depending on what type of line we're talking about here. And so then you have this really interesting additional layer for fan pilgrims of being not a super fan, but having had this experience that, like, validates you calling yourself a fan in particular ways. And that is something that maybe a lot of fans want to have and can't. The studio tour is really expensive. It is really expensive to get to London if you aren't in the UK, and that type of thing. So it creates these power dynamics that I think are, you know, really evident in pilgrimage as a in a broad sense, in a way that maybe they aren't as evident in tourism, because there is this underlying sense of at least an imagined community, a narrative that you are subscribing to, and then this social power that's generated by having been there or by sending people postcards from a place or bringing people souvenirs. And I think that, you know, in the case of these fan pilgrimage places with gift shops, there is a lot of continuity to people who would go to Jerusalem and bring back for their church or for their family members, you know, a little cross with dirt from Jerusalem in it, which, you know, people did in the medieval period.
Yeah, and they did in early modern as well. So that was one of the other connections I was finding in the journey, is that they all brought back wood from the Mount of Olives. They all brought back water from the Dead Sea. They all brought back earth from anywhere in Jerusalem. And you thought they were bringing back exactly the same things as medieval pilgrims did. That's rather... And it was quite fun. Actually, I went to a conference about Jerusalem a while ago, and I gave this paper, and someone who was a modern sociologist of tourism and pilgrimage in Jerusalem said, oh, that's brilliant, because he was looking at something. He wanted to find a way of comparing different faiths. So he wanted to find Jews and Christians and Muslims visiting Jerusalem and trying to find some way of comparing their experience. And he said, oh yes, what they take away, that's I can look at all of them and see what the continuities are or the differences are in those things. So that was quite fun. I said, yep, they're still doing it now, so you can still still do this.
Right. So, and I think souvenirs are a great indicator of how people relate to a place, like how they related to it at the time, but also the significance that it comes to have to them later. You know, it's one thing to, you know, send a postcard because, hey, this was fun, and it's another thing to, you know, invest some money and some time in getting an object that, even if it's mass-produced, has some kind of symbolic meaning to you, and then displaying it in your home where other people are going to see it, and where when you see it, you know, you are reminded of both the narrative of you making that trip and the narrative that it represents. And I'm not going to say that those are always, you know, objects in a shrine in your house, but they could be. They could just be, you know, reminders of something really meaningful. And that, to me, functions in a way that is very similar to these medieval, early modern relics that you're talking about.
There's a practice among Orthodox Christian faithful to go to the Holy Sepulchre on Pascha or Easter to capture the holy fire, which appears miraculously every year on the old calendar day for Pascha. And that fire is brought to Orthodox countries, both in Central Europe, Greece, even to the United States, the Orthodox Church is here. And I think, we have a category.
How does it travel? How do they get the
They have special lanterns. They've been doing this for hundreds of years.
So it goes on boats.
They have special lanterns that they have. Because
you couldn't
carry.
Take it on a plane.
They do.
Really?
They have stations to carry the holy fire on plane. Yeah. And that lights lampadas in churches and in people's homes. And this is the divine fire of Christ's resurrection, and has been testified to for more than a millennium. Now, this is a category different than a token that is produced by Warner Brothers or others as a memorial of a trip that's made, that has associations perhaps with some mythic or religious experience for someone who doesn't have access to transcendent graces. I feel obliged to say that again, that these experiences that are truly contact with what's divine and sacred are different than those when people feel they're having meaningful emotional experiences for arriving at a place that they invest themselves individually with some meaning.
It Go might fire the same places in the brain, mightn't it, John, in terms of having your thing that you take away and then it reminds you of that thing that's important to you, that it might well be a same. I think it's the same kind of human desire, even if you know, you sense objectively it's not so meaningful, but it might well be quite just the same.
Individual emotional experience. But I mean, that's the Eliade thesis, is that story fulfills this need for contact with something transcendent in the human person when the access to the real divine and sacred has been denied by the culture at large. Hence Pottermania, in large part because of the suffusion of the text with Christian symbols and resurrection imagery, for example. That's one thing that drives fascination with Harry Potter, is that it gives us that experience in spades, much as do, say, The Lord of the Rings and The Chronicles of Narnia and similar books.
I think this is a really interesting issue that is kind of at the crux of doing projects like the one that I'm working on, and it takes a lot of digging to sort of get at how to handle it. And I think that for a lot of people, you may be right, like, going to a place associated with Harry Potter, reading the Harry Potter books, creates a kind of myth that, of course, does not have any divine connotations, but maybe takes the place of, you know, religious experience. But I think we should not automatically rule out that sacred space could be created in ways that don't really have anything to do with traditional religion or a sense of the divine. I think that for the way that I'm approaching this, the divine, as in transcendent forces, deities, stuff like that, is not a limiter on the sacred.
There's just your idea of people creating their own sacred space. There's a beautiful sign up at the stairs of John Lateran in Rome, and there are these special stairs you can climb up on your knees, and the faithful indeed, you know, do. And they are the stairs that Jesus ascended to get into Pilate's house from Jerusalem. And so the question is, you know, what are they doing in Rome? And the answer is that angels brought them there at some early Christian time. And there's a sign which says, you know, you might have some doubts about whether these really are the real stairs that Jesus walked up in Jerusalem, but they have been prayed at by the community of the faithful as those stairs, and that is what makes them sacred. I think that's an amazing thing, you know, put up by the church there, and you think, yeah, well, so that's an interesting example.
And that's the mediation. I mean, that's basically them sort of saying, you know, this is how we're going to give you some ideas about how you can think about this particular experience, what your interpretation might be.
I just think that's, you know, T.S. Eliot says about Little Gidding, he says it is a place where prayer has been valid, and that's his idea of what makes that a sacred space.
Right, and I mean, I had a similar experience in Rome. I took an archaeological tour. They show you, you know, what is believed to be the tomb of St. Peter, like down under the Vatican.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had an archaeologist who works for the Vatican. She presented sort of their interpretation of, you know, how do we know that this is Peter's tomb? What tells us this? And you can engage with that or not, you know, and it really depends on, you know, what the individual person's belief system is. And, you know, St. Peter is not at the Warner Brothers studio tour. But I really like the T.S. Eliot idea that you quoted, Bea, that this is a place where people have done something, perhaps not prayed, that engages with a really personal meaning-making exercise that has to do with this text. And I'm just not willing to rule out that can be an experience of the sacred.
Well, one of the things that I think has sort of hovered over our discussion on this has to do with commercialism, you know, and the commercialism of having the gift shop right there, and what are you going to take away in terms of your souvenir, and how does the commercial affect, particularly whether the tourist feels they've gotten an authentic experience, and whether the pilgrim is experiencing the sacred. Like, how can the commercial and the sacred coexist in these spaces?
Yeah. Oh gosh, there are so many things in that question.
Sorry, it's a big question.
No. It's good. And I'm going to, I think, start with the end of it, how the commercial and the sacred can coexist. Yeah, that's probably the best way to approach it. But when I look at this, one thing that I've read in the course of my research that I found really interesting, because it just provides a very different perspective, is some material on pilgrimage in Japan. And in Japan, a lot of pilgrimage practices are influenced by Shinto, which has, you know, an idea of sacredness being more all-pervasive than is typical in Western ideas about sacred space. And a lot of pilgrimage places in Japan are in commercial spaces, or they coexist with commercial spaces, or there is a commercial space in the temple. And you don't have this question of, does commercialism make pilgrimage inauthentic? Like, it's just not a starting point, an assumption that people come in with. And I mention this, you know, not because we're talking about pilgrimages in Japan, but because I think it's a useful way to remind ourselves to kind of step back from this assumption that the mass-produced and the commercial are somehow antithetical to the authentic and the sacred. Because, you know, if you look critically at the history of pilgrimage in the West, too, that's clearly not the case. The place where you wait in line, for example, to get into the cathedral at Santiago, it's around the side of the cathedral. And my Spanish is not good enough to remember the Spanish name of this, but the plaza that you're in is called the Plaza of the Silversmiths, because for hundreds and hundreds of years, this has been the place where the silversmiths had all their shops. And so for hundreds of years, if you had the money, you could go into these places and buy a St. James cross, which is it's a particular shape of a cross, and take it with you into the cathedral and potentially, you know, have it blessed by a priest. And of course, in Jerusalem, taking back olive wood objects, taking back sand, taking back water, taking back fire, as, you know, we've been saying, like, these are long traditions. And so, you know, we have to recognize that the commercial and the sacred have always been co-present in pilgrimage.
You also look at not only the Warner Brothers studio tour, things that have been, I mean, it's advertising for their films in a way. But you also looked at fans going to places like Christ Church or the Bodleian Library, and how those also can become experiences, and they have less of a commercial element, but it's not totally absent from those experiences. So how do you see those as being different in terms of the way that commerce is maybe playing a role, or the you know, the mediation, or the purpose that it serves for fans?
Yeah, I Well, those sites are, as you say, a little bit different. I would point out that people are still selling stuff in gift shops there.
Right.
It's Christchurch is really quite interesting because Christchurch is also an Anglican pilgrimage site. That there's a saint's tomb there that's very specific to the history of Oxford. And so you do have people who go to Christchurch Cathedral on pilgrimage for reasons that have absolutely nothing to do with Harry Potter. And in the bookshop there at Christchurch, you can buy Harry Potter stuff, and you can also buy stuff that is, you know, related to Oxford history and Christchurch Cathedral's specific history.
I've spoken to some fellows of Christchurch about the way in which most visitors now are the Harry Potter related visitors, and some of them have expressed to me this sort of sadness that it's now Harry Potter which doesn't have any relationship as a book with Christchurch, rather than Alice, which is what it used to be. Everyone used to go to Christchurch. In their narrative, pilgrimage to Christchurch was about Alice in Wonderland. Mm-hmm. And that was written by someone who lived in Christchurch, and there's various bits of Christchurch that you can see. So they've got fenders with long necks that are the inspiration for Alice's neck growing and things like that. And I have wondered, and I'm trying to try and mute to the Christchurch gift shop, of writing a book called The Real Connection Between Harry Potter and Christchurch, which would be about the way in which literary texts that are genuinely connected to Christchurch have themselves inspired Rowling, like Alice, which would be kind of fun. So that would be a sort of, as it were, anti-Harry Potter pilgrimage to Christchurch, but cashing in on it nonetheless. But
well, looking at the intertextual history of, you know, people going to Christchurch, you know, at all, right? How does this come out of Alice in Wonderland, of Harry Potter, of Saint Frideswyde, I think, right?
Frideswyde,
thank you.
You're right. I mean, Frideswyde is the Anglo-Saxon. Frideswyde is what she's called in Oxford in modern times.
Right. So you have these like layers of narratives really that motivate people there. I think Christchurch is super interesting for that reason, and I hope that you write that book.
I would buy that book.
Yeah.
Excellent. Yay. I must get on with it.
Yeah. I think the other thing that's really interesting to me about Christchurch is you have this combination of places where filming was actually conducted, in the cloister and at the stairway in the hall, and then places that inspired the film creators. So it didn't necessarily inspire Rowling, but inspired the directors of the first few movies. So Chris Columbus, I guess that would be, if we're thinking back to films 1 and 2. So the hall, right? The hall has no like literal on-screen appearance in Harry Potter.
Right.
But
yeah,
it is, you know, it has a lot of significance for people who go there and they want to see, okay, where did the hall come from? So you have this kind of blending of people who want to think about the creative history and then people who want to see how the fictional world was like physically, literally right here brought to life. And it shows sort of the diversity of those narrative motivations.
I remember John asked me a while ago about the alchemical symbols that are on the wall in the hall in Christchurch, in when it's Hogwarts Hall. And I had to disappoint him and say that they're not there in the real. That's an example of how they've created a fake one. But it was fun. But I was like, no, there's no all-seeing eye in the real one.
Darn it.
But for me, I think Christchurch is a good example of sort of one of the things that feels different to me about film locations was that when I saw, because I already knew Christchurch, when I saw the film, I just think there's Christchurch stairway, you know, there's New College, masquerading as Hogwarts. So I don't, when I then see them, I can't feel that these are Hogwarts places. You know, that only works if you've seen them for the first time in the film. Whereas it doesn't matter if I knew someone already, if I read that, so I go to the places in Dorset that Hardy was inspired by, it doesn't matter if I'd already seen those rivers. Once I've read the Hardy book about them, I want to go and see them again in that different light. It feels quite different to me.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, it feels different depending on what your familiarity is already, combined with, you know, what your investment in the narrative is. You know, I feel very differently about seeing parts of Christchurch or the Divinity School in Oxford than I do. I'm from Atlanta, right? So, you know, there's lots of Atlanta landmarks in The Walking Dead, which I'm not particularly a fan of, but it's fun to see, you know, screen stills and say, oh, I know where that is. That's in the middle of Georgia State University and somebody's getting eaten by a zombie. But I don't have the kind of like fascination with places that are familiar seen on screen that I have with places that are unfamiliar.
Yeah, we have that, you know, we have this TV show called Morse in Oxford. Mm-hmm. And basically everyone in Oxford watches it just to go, I know that, that's my street, or that's, you know, but it doesn't feel special at all. It's just kind of fun spotting them, and often I'm able to say I saw that being filmed, because you walk past them filming it in the morning and you think, oh, I must go and watch that next when it comes on TV, so I'll be able to say I was just out of shot in that shot.
Right, and yet you have tourists who come to Oxford specifically because they want to go to all the pubs in, you know, Morse and Lewis and Endeavour, that, you know, probably are not what folks in Oxford are thinking of when they're going, you know, down to the White Horse or something.
No, that's right. That feels like Morse is in our pub, not that we're in Morse's pub. So.
Yes. It's an outsider experience, right? A pilgrimage is an outsider experience. Outsider trying to get into the inside of something. Well, Caroline, I'm sorry to say we're at the end of our time here, but I want to ask you, you know, what's next for you in this topic? Are there other pilgrimage experiences that Harry Potter fans enact that you're interested in replicating or studying? Or are there, I know that you look at Doctor Who, you look at Sherlock. So what's next for you, Caroline?
Well, I'm currently working on this dissertation project that, as you say, involves Harry Potter and Doctor Who and Sherlock. And one thing that's interesting to me in thinking about places and how places work over the course of this project is how immersion happens, and what people are immersed in, and, you know, which places really have immersive qualities and which places maybe don't. So I would really like to go to, and I'm planning to go to, the Wizarding Worlds in Orlando, the Harry Potter theme exhibit. That, of course, has nothing to do with production. There was no filming there. You know, it didn't. There wasn't anything there for Rowling to be inspired by. It's just a recreation of certain places within the films. But the idea is to, like, really bring fans into feeling like they're there. So I'm really interested in seeing how that works and how similar attractions related to Doctor Who compare to places that have more to do with the history of production or spaces that have appeared on screen.
That's interesting. The immersive and the others, maybe, I don't know, is it more like a museum? Museums can be immersive too, but maybe I shouldn't build a false wall there.
Right. I think that, you know, one of the interesting things about the studio tour is that it parts of it are like a museum and parts of it are like, walk into the Great Hall, feel the expansiveness of the Great Hall around you, that you have these moments of, I can't say that every fan gets immersed in the narrative, but the attraction is created in a way that wants you to be immersed for a moment in the narrative. And you kind of go back and forth. Whereas something like the Wizarding World, you know, it strives to generate a more continuous immersion. Uh-huh. And, you know, going along with the idea of are people immersed or not, I think is the question of how do heavily mediated sites like that, studio-owned sites like that, try to create that immersion, and to what extent do they succeed, and to what extent do fans rebel against that? That's really interesting to me.
Oh, yeah, right. And I love that. We didn't really get a chance to talk about the, you know, the way, the boundaries and the way that they're trying to guide you and shape you and the way that you experience it, and that, you know, relates to authenticity. And I love the rebellious, I love anything that's rebellious myself, but the idea that fans are looking for ways that they can kind of undercut some of those boundaries. That's cool. Well, thank you so much, Caroline Toy.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
It was great to interrogate this aspect of the Harry Potter fandom, and really interesting. I love Harry Potter, and then I had just been doing this tourism stuff, and I was like, oh my gosh, I had never really thought about it in that way, and you have enlightened me on that. How interesting. And thanks.
Well, I'm very happy to, and if any listeners are interested in kind of learning more about this, as part of my dissertation project, I am doing some survey research, and writing some stuff about what I'm finding online. So I have a blog at fanpilgrimageproject.tumblr.com. And if anybody wants to visit that or take part in the research, they're welcome to do so.
That's great. Can you just say that one more time so any fans who want to participate can...
Yeah, any fans who would like to participate in the survey phase of this research project, if you've been to any Harry Potter attractions, you can go to fanpilgrimageproject.tumblr.com.
Okay.
And there's also material there for folks who want to read further, including the paper that I gave at the Pop Culture Association.
That's great. Wonderful. I always like to give homework to our listeners. But that sounds like fun. And I, you know, having experienced, you know, a lot of Harry Potter fandom, you know, we like to share our experiences. So I hope you get a lot of feedback there.
Yeah, so do I. I would love to hear from as many people as possible.
Great. Well, and of course, thanks, John Granger, for being our continuing expert guest. Listeners, be on the alert for signups for John's online class, Wizard Reading Formula. And thank you to Bea Groves. Bea, thank you for helping us kind of connect early modern pilgrim experiences into the Harry Potter world.
Thank you. I suspect that's a first. You never know.
I know. I love the sort of unexpected connections. Really interesting. What an interesting conversation we had today. Our technical editor in Australia is Emma Nicholson, and she does a fantastic job for us, even when we throw lots of obstacles in her way. Thank you, Emma, so much for editing our show for us. We really appreciate you. And we also appreciate our partners at MuggleNet, the number one Harry Potter fan site, and our new MuggleNet liaison, Renee McBrien. Welcome to the team, Renee. We're looking forward to working more with you on especially our social media presence. And so listeners, of course, we very much appreciate you being here with us. We are really excited to hear from you. And if you want to contact us at readingwritingrolling@gmail.com, you can visit our Facebook page. We're also at Read, Write, Roll on Twitter. And I thought I would share with you a part of a letter that we received from one of our listeners who said how much he's enjoying the podcast and, as he says, the, quote, different levels of literary dissection that occur within every episode. He also said this, which I really appreciate and I think is a good statement for our times. He said, "I also enjoy all the different opinions and political views that your show encases. After listening to episode 10, that's the episode with Adele Amini, I wanted to jump up in the air and shout. It was so refreshing to listen to the journalist Adele Amini and yourself, John, converse in such a positive manner. Even though each of you have obvious different views on religion, politics, etc., your conversation was not hindered in the slightest. I hope the world at large can move forward with more and more positive conversations happening around things we all love, such as Harry Potter." I totally agree with you, dear listener. And one of the joys of doing this podcast is being able to connect over something that we all love, Harry Potter. So if you would like to send us a comment or a show idea, we are very much interested in hearing from you. And I will leave you all with the wisdom of Hogwarts headmaster Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, who said, "Words are, in my not-so-humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it." We'll see you next time, where we'll be using our words to make some magic.